Ladies and gentlemen, the glorious return is upon us. You all thought us dead. You thought you were past this point in your life. No more wrestling podcasts. No more things from friends. No, we're on to bigger and better things. You didn't know that the bigger and better thing that you were on to was the revival. And this time, Ryan, it is not fuck the revival. This time it is for the revival. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to FFC. I am your host, Master Damian Gentile Ellinghouse, accompanied as always by good friend and lover of the color white and doves and flowers, Ryan Drummond.
Excuse me.
Did I get it wrong?
We're keeping my name.
Oh.
keeping my name in this house.
Yeah, see, Ryan's not a good, an actual feminist. See, I hyphenate my last name, but he's like, no, we adhere to traditions. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a long couple of months. But in these couple of months, we do not come to you as the same men. No, no, no. Ryan comes to you bedded and wetted. He is a new man with rings on fingies. And I come to you fresh out of social work school, back in the real world that I never left, full of chaos and horrible things.
But you know, getting your nice 14-year degree, that's something to be proud of.
Yeah, you know, it's you know, my mom said, "Boy, you know, Damian, what's the thing that you're proudest about yourself?" And I was like, "I tell you, I found a really, really easy way to lose $50,000."
Yeah,
some people go to the horse track. Not me. I'm no degenerate. I go by textbooks.
That's right. FAFSA, baby. FAFSA over Seabiscuit.
So now that the chaos of the last few months, the rush to finish a degree, the rush to finish planning a wedding, these things are behind us. And we've got
nonsense. We should have talked wrestling the entire time.
Yes. Everybody knows that wrestling is at its best when you put everything in life before. Well, you put wrestling before that. And we were too weak. But now we're not. Now we're strong.
As is tradition, you know, everything breaks today. Some good, some bad and tragic on the day that we're recording. So we are fresh with a bunch of news stories, events going on.
Yeah, fresh content.
Because, you know, the beacon was calling. That's what it was. The hills are lit on fire. The eagles are soaring up in the sky. We knew that it was time to return home.
Yes, Gondor called for aid, and we answered. I don't know what did good things happen today? Oh, I guess there was one pretty big thing that broke
today. Some good
today.
Tidbits, you know. I don't want to say the passing of a wrestler forced us to record.
Yes.
There's some fun inklings going on otherwise.
Yes, today we will not just be catching you up on some various happenings and just kind of getting back into the groove, but it is the, you can't exactly say untimely, but it is the nonetheless tragic passing of Terry Funk earlier today. Terrence Funk, one of the true remaining pioneers in the industry, left. In the last few years, we're not super kind to the Funkster, but he still kind of maintained that edge that everybody loved him for as much as possible. So we're going to say a few words about the Funk Man, and then we'll get into some happenings. And so, in honor of Terry, I've got with me here just the most Terry Funk beer I could think of, which, of course, it's not. If it was a good Terry Funk beer, it would be. Well, actually, here's something interesting. He wasn't born in Texas.
He was not. No, I wrote up a whole thing. And
he was born in Indiana. So
to fit our motive, he is a boy from the West Plains of Texas.
Yeah, so it should have been Lone Star, but it's not.
That's like finding out CCR was born in California, not Louisiana.
Yep.
Fogarty, John Fogarty. There you go. I'm a very consummate musical historian, that's for sure.
So I instead have got some Gansett, which I guess I could probably work into, like, you know, the Northeast. The Northeast was an important part of wrestling, so that's why I picked this.
It's a working man's beer, you know.
It's a working man's beer, exactly, for the working man.
I definitely do not have the working man's beer. I have some special boy degenerate beer. I have the Lagunitas Tiki Fusion.
Ah, a man.
It's a zombie cocktail inspired IPA. It has orange, lime, grapefruit, and allspice to really just knock your ass off on a Wednesday night.
How strong is it?
10 ABV.
Yeah, if it's going to be zombie-based, you got to go strong.
Exactly.
I had a whole tiki night. I've been big into tiki folks lately. I've been really spending a lot of money on rums and making syrups and shit. And, you know, it requires a big bar to do.
Well,
tiki
I have to get
shit
on my tiki game because I will be visiting the land of tikis for my honeymoon. Going to fabulous Bora Bora.
I guess, yeah, there's some tikis there. There's,
sure,
there's,
you know,
there's
a, I don't want to generalize cultures here, but, you know, the theme is there. I will be sipping on some island-inspired cocktails at the very least.
Well, that is that's the whole thing of tiki, is that it's called Polynesian pop, and it is an inherent hodgepodge of shit. One day I'll talk about tiki. Maybe I'll do an episode on the Samoans, and then I'll find a way to work tiki into that.
Maybe our first, it's funny how we still haven't done a live episode since...
It's
shut down, but maybe a fun idea for a live episode will be like, we'll do a whole episode on the Samoan family, wear some nice Hawaiian shirts, and have some cocktails as we discuss.
A buddy of mine decided to do all eight the big tiki drinks, you know, your Mai Tais, your zombies, your all that. And we got to zombie and I was like, listen, we got to drink like five other drinks after this, so let's not make it with as much overproof rum. He ignored that. Right after that came a scorpion bowl. I said, okay, this recipe is for four people, so make sure to cut it in half. He didn't. So two people drank a four-person scorpion bowl right after drinking a zombie, after drinking a Mai Tai. So, you know, just it was I'm diabetic now. Anyway, to the funkster we crack.
To the legend.
And we salute the legend himself. Really is a working man's beer.
Oh boy.
All right.
Oh man, you really taste that allspice.
It's like the one overwhelming flavor you got there.
Didn't need it, but all right.
Mostly hops and allspice. All right, Ryan. So Ryan has prepared a little thing for us. So let's all bow our heads and give him the proper respect that he deserves as he takes us through the life of one Terrence Funk.
Today, we saw the passing of one of wrestling's global citizens. Few professional wrestlers win a championship, but even fewer, if any, have reached the pinnacles that Terry Funk has reached in his career. Terry Funk, from the West Plains of Texas, was able to stretch his legend across continents and oceans. Terry, along with his brother Dory, who is a legend in his own right, being one of history's greatest teachers, innovators, quickly scorched a path through territories in the South, and fewer than a decade later, Terry was already champion of the premier wrestling territory of the day, NWA. Throughout that reign, he saw 14 different titles with titans like Giant Baba, Harley Race, Dusty Rhodes, so on and so forth. Terry probably could have called it a day in the late 70s. I believe his first retirement match was when Undertaker wrestled high school.
Mm-hmm.
Another wrestling retirement that he had was before even Bron Breakker was born.
Mm-hmm.
But even at that point, Terry Funk stretched his career another 14 years after that. 50 years. You know, people talk about Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak, Jerry Rice's touchdown reception record. But I think one streak, not necessarily a streak, but an achievement that many people, if any, are going to achieve now is stretching your wrestling career across 50 years. Terry could have called it quits in the late 70s, and, you know, he would be spoken about in the same degree that Harley Race and Ric Flair are today. But he decided to go over to Japan. And as you're familiar with, Damian became one of the premier gaijin. Even more than that, you know, I don't think he was even viewed as, you know, that, necessarily that label. He was viewed as the industry's premier workers. You know, from the Lemmy documentary, Lemmy always talks about, you know, I remember before rock and roll. Well, not necessarily that Terry Funk remembers before professional wrestling. Terry Funk certainly remembers before the changes of the industry that he's seen in those 50 years, where Terry had a dearth of just innovative moves. You know, he always knew what was coming next, no matter if he was facing Harley Race or if he was facing Tommy Dreamer and Sandman in ECW. He was, you know, we lost that consummate, you know, achievement of just knowledge in wrestling. And, you know, I think if you went across 20 fans today and asked them, you know, give me your Mount Rushmore, not many people are going to say Terry Funk, and they certainly should. You know, at least to people in my age, you know, my first interaction with Funk was when he was Chainsaw Charlie in WWF. Do you remember that?
Chainsaw Charlie, that definitely awakened something there, yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely, I don't know if this was their idea or Vince was just like, yeah, you can't be Terry Funk out there. You got to be Chainsaw Charlie. And it was when I think Cactus Jack was coming back against DX and he needed some backup. So he had this giant plywood box on stage and this guy wearing a stocking mask with a chainsaw came out and there he was. But I think Jerry Lawler quickly was like, ah, let's get Terry Funk. But, you know, later on, we recognized, a lot of youngins recognized Terry Funk in the Hell in a Cell match, who it was his great idea to give Mick some more time by, and if you ever wondered why this occurred, going up to Undertaker and be like, chokeslam now, and gave him an immediate chokeslam right out of his white New Balance. But,
literally,
you know,
chokeslammed him out his shoes.
Terry Funk had the instinct to do things like that.
You know? Well, I think to that point, what most people, like, people our age know Terry Funk in a very different way than people, you know, than Gen X or our parents' generations or even our grandparents' generations would know Terry Funk, because Terry Funk was nothing if not a trailblazer. Terry Funk was a guy that was absolutely a product of his time, you know, a product of his father Dory's gym. You know, he was your consummate territories wrestler, but he had an instinct, to your point. He had an instinct for like what would work and what you could do that ultimately, you know, what are they, what's Dreamer's nickname? What is it? It's like what the originator of violence or some shit.
Yeah, something like that.
That's Terry Funk. Terry Funk is in many ways the grandfather of the hardcore match. He is responsible for the true introduction of violence into wrestling. And he did it with style and finesse. And, you know, Terry Funk could be on any given day the guy being cheered to the rafters, or he could be drowned out in booze. Like he really knew how to work a crowd. He knew how to work a match, And I think that's what really allowed him to be successful. I mean, to put in perspective here, Terry Funk's debut in 1965 was 2 years after Buddy Rogers and Lou Thesz held the NWA championship. And Terry Funk's true retirement happened maybe sometime around Nick Aldis being NWA champion.
Which is insane to think about, that his career stretched across the hands of Buddy Rogers to Nick Aldis.
Like, that's the level of longevity that you're talking about. And it is a longevity that was spurred on by knowing how to adapt to the changing tides. One of the few territory wrestlers that I think really did, you know, a lot of those guys, they kind of got lost in the shuffle. But when you look at the people in the territories who you're like, oh, these are the guys, you know, your Ric Flairs, your Stings, your Dusties, like, a lot of them felt like throwbacks to a bygone era, but they also were timeless in their own right way. But Terry just kept evolving while still somehow remaining the same. And that's why, to your point, like, I don't know how many people our age or, you know, up to like their 40s or 50s might necessarily call Terry Funk their favorite wrestler of all time. But I think you'd be hard pressed to find a single wrestler or person who's been even kind of involved in the business who wouldn't call Terry Funk the GOAT.
The fans maybe one thing, but wrestlers certainly. And talk about one of the greatest second acts in your wrestling career. Terry had it, you know. He was pretty much done up to the point of 2006 at ECW One Night Stand, but came back, and not only that, just had a fucking absolutely fantastic match with his protege Mick Foley against Edge. And I forget who Edge was tagging with at the time, but regardless, just a fantastic match. Does the eye spot. I totally bought it at the time because I didn't realize that was Terry's calling card. But after that, he went into TNA and went into the indies. You know, this 50-year-old man at that point did not need necessarily do that, but, you know, it was his lifeblood. And a perfect example with, you know, you saw Ric Flair wrestle up into 2007, 2012, you were seeing a Ric Flair match, but Terry was beyond that, and you were seeing a hardcore match, and you're seeing with the Godfather of hardcore. And yeah, just absolute loss. But the last, as you said, the last couple of years have been rough to him, and we're glad to see him at peace now, for certain.
It was reported on that, like, he had dementia, and pictures started coming out, and, you know, by that time, like, around 2021, 2020, he's in a home. You know, look, he leaves us at 79, right? It is a long, long life, and it's a long life in spite of how he adapted to, or how he became the progeny of hardcore. You know, it's a shock, honestly. But, you know, I think the thing that for people who now find themselves fans and don't know what it was like to watch a Terry Funk match or kind of see why he was so important, you know, some of his feuds, one of his big feuds against Lawler in Memphis, they had like an empty stadium match and, you know, cut a hell of a promo. Fans may remember his I Quit match against Ric Flair for the NWA championship.
And if you're going to watch a Terry Funk match tonight, watch that.
His one of his many matches against Harley Race in the 80s, you know, all the way up to ECW. You know, you can really, that's the thing about Terry Funk, is you can watch him throughout all of these decades and kind of be amazed at the shit that you would see him do, because he just always seemed one step ahead of the curve. You know, Keiji Muto, 20 years his senior, just had his retirement match. And it was clear that, he needed to retire. He was about 17 years younger. But Keiji Mudo, right, is a guy who was kind of always himself. And Funk was always himself, but he just, I don't know, he just had this innate quality where he knew how to connect with crowds, twist them however he needed to. And he understood ring psychology in a way that, like, that's the thing that I think Terry brought from the territories to ECW, to WWE, to WCW, is he really had that way of manipulating you in a ring and really tugging on the heartstrings where he wanted to. And I think that's what made him so endearing. And in Japan, the Funks were as famous as Stan Hansen and Bruiser Bodie. The Funks were extremely well liked, much like the Steiners after them, because again, Terry just kind of knew how to adapt. And Dory is one of the most underrated tag team wrestlers of all time, aside from being, an NWA champion in his own right. And as Ryan said, Dory, there's a reason why Dory became known as maybe the ultimate trainer for some of your favorite wrestlers. These guys just had such a strong technical background to go along with everything else that they kind of brought to the table. I feel like what separated Dory and Terry was Terry's promos.
Right. Terry was such a larger than life figure than his brother, but by no means is that necessarily diminished from Dory, but exactly what you said. Look at these stats. He was a All Japan champion, NWA champion, Extreme Wrestling ECW champion. The list goes on and on. And that's what we almost mourn today. I don't want to say that this is like the death of one of the last true professional wrestlers, because it's very insulting as a portly man who is not an athlete, yes. a NARP. Non-athlete role player. I don't want to diminish anybody in the business today, but Terry Funk wasn't an acrobat. Terry Funk wasn't just working off character work. He truly epitomizes the lost art of professional wrestling in terms of the 70s and the 80s, so that's what we almost, not only do we mourn the man, we mourn the loss of that knowledge. We mourn the loss of that, that masterful craft that he had. He was just an innovator, and it's certainly, he may be gone today, but we'll be speaking his name. Our children will be speaking his name. It's beyond that. So,
that's the nickname I was thinking of. Tommy Dreamer's the innovator of violence.
Yeah.
And
he's the innovator. Terry Funk is the original.
Terry Funk is, simply put, his body of work lives on through people like Mick Foley and anybody that's ever watched a Cactus Jack or a Mankind or a Mick Foley match and thought, that's the way I want to be. Mick Foley credits Terry with like being able to cut those heartfelt promos, those. I think that's one of the things that made Terry different in a lot of ways, too, was he didn't need to. He kind of had a similar, when he was healing it up, he had a similar kind of vibe to Jake the Snake, where he didn't necessarily need to scream to make you scared of him. Like, he didn't need to do the whole roided up 80s cocaine fueled hysteria, Lex Luger shtick to get his point across. The end of the I Quit match against him and Ric Flair, when Rick has him in the figure four and, they're like, give up. And he's like, no, God almighty, he's breaking my leg, God almighty. Like, you really did buy it. It's like,
yeah,
is he actually going to break his leg there? But it is, as time goes on and the sport evolves, today we honor one of the last remaining stalwarts of a bygone era, but somebody whose spirit lives on through the innovation of your John Moxley's, of your, I mean, honestly, Moxley's usually the person that comes to mind when I think of like a Terry Funk adjacent right now. But anybody,
any brawler that exists today,
your FTRs, you know, just anybody that brawls and has that technical background, you know, Terry Funk is probably the inspiration. And you know, all I can really think also is like, Mick really does just get dealt fucking hand after hand, doesn't he?
He does, and sadly, I think he'd be the first person to tell you that not only did, you know, he expects this, but, you know, anytime you see someone pass in wrestling where, you know, anybody looks back on them, you know, he posted the picture with him, like, you know, Mick Foley and Terry went hand in hand, and he posted a picture of them on Twitter, and you're just like, oh my God, like, the master is gone. You know, just the little things too. Like, you forget sometimes. Like, for example, like when Mick Foley ripped off his ear, right? He was doing the hangman spot.
Mm.
And you forget, like, wrestling is comprised of, I don't want to say stuntman, but like comprised of those, you know, those moves and elements that are not lost, but it meant so much back then, you know? And Terry was at the forefront of that. Yeah. I don't even want to think of the episode that we're going to do with Mick, but, you know, I think it strengthens Mick in a way, because Mick is one of the great orators of the business, and he's certainly going to be the forebearer of that torch for Terry moving forward.
And I think probably another big, like, connection between the two, and maybe what is the reason why Terry will be so heralded for time immemorial, is Terry Funk is also one of the very few people that came up in his era that doesn't really have a controversy to point to.
No.
You know, I mean, listen, shit comes out of the woodworks all the time, so I could certainly eat my words by the end of this. However, one of the things that people always talk about is that Terry Funk was somebody who he was always willing to teach. He was always willing to show people, you know, where he was coming from, never afraid to do the job if that's what made sense. You know, a guy whose life is not filled with untold drug use and sexual assaults and assaults, like every single person almost that Terry Funk comes up with has just a litany of shit that they did, because that was the industry, right? That the boys will just be the boys. And I feel like one of the reasons why Terry Funk is like the wrestler's wrestler is because that was his fucking life. That was it. Terry Funk he wasn't out there making movies. He wasn't going on the Daily Show. He wasn't fucking around trying to be a celebrity or being a fucking creep or just trying to amass as much power as possible and inflict shit on other people. This dude just wanted to wrestle. He just wanted to tell his stories in the way he wanted to tell them, in the media he wanted to tell them. And I think that that is maybe his most defining legacy, is that in a time where everybody was shit, he managed to somehow escape the smell.
Yeah, and on it, he knew where to separate, you know, Terrence Funk from Terry Funk, you know. One last note I want to mention was, you know, on Twitter, Jeff Cannonball obituized? He wrote an obituary for Terry, and he said he worked a show back in the Indies a couple of years ago, and he saw Terry was the head trainer for the day, head matchmaker, and, you know, he wanted to go up to Terry and get a picture with him, but the rule was, you know, don't be a mark. But that was his biggest regret, that he didn't go up and have that conversation and perhaps get that picture.
I will say Terry did have a Western that he made in 85, but
it's fine. It's fine. Let him have his Western.
It lasted six episodes, and that was about it.
It's like Bret Hart and Lonesome Dove.
Yeah.
Which is like my one of my uncle's favorite shows of all time. And I'm like, you're Bret Hart's on that. He goes, who? I'm like,
oh my God. Yeah, so Terry Funk is a guy that I would do a disservice to listeners to try to act like I knew enough about his overall body of work to recommend any particular matches. But all I can really tell you is like the I Quit match against Flair, the tag match against Foley and Edge, really any of his stuff in ECW when he was teaming up with Dreamer, and really any match between him and Harley Race, or in Japan against Baba, like any of those those are his big feuds that you'll see, you know, him and Dusty, him and Rick, him and Baba, those, any match that you can find that's really what you want to watch.
If you go on YouTube, you know, God knows what's still preserved from that era, but just type in Terry Funk versus any wrestler you could think of back in the day and you will find him.
Yeah.
Go on Peacock tonight, go watch ECW. And I could speak for anything too, because I think Davey would be the first person to point out the flaws of a man, but we can. We really can. And I don't want to say that Terry didn't have his demons or that, you know, he didn't have issues in his life, but you know, Terry, exactly what Damian mentioned was that he was able to separate himself from all that and give to us at the end of the day that this is a wrestler. I will always be a wrestler forever and ever.
Yeah. In fact, to that point, the things that you might know Terry Funk most controversially for, if you literally type in Terry Funk controversy, is Terry Funk beats the shit out of an alleged pedophile.
Yes.
And Terry Funk had an assault on a rival promotion's wrestler.
Oh, that's funny. Which may have been kayfabe, keep in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, right? Like, they were just like, all right, let's rustle up and get the local sheriff on us and get us some heat.
that's kind of about it. That's like the shit you'll find is the business was maybe a little too real to Funker at times. he didn't start doing the reason he started doing hardcore matches is because he was like, I need to find a way to hit that egg sucking dog with a chair. God damn it.
Pretty much that's what it was. I mean, you think Texas, like, that's his originator. You know, you say like Razor Ramon and Shawn Michaels had the ladder match. He has the original hardcore match because that was just
the Texas Death.
That was just such like a Southern Texas wrestling thing, you know.
So you know, go do yourselves some favors and go just watch anything from between the 70s and 90s, and you'll be content. But like I said, Flair, Baba, Race, Dusty, those are the feuds you'll end up, you know, remembering from him. So as we move out of that, right, past to present to future here, quite a bit's happened in the last couple of months we've been away, notably the G1.
That's right, the Rudy Giuliani mugshot.
The Rudy Giuliani
hilarious.
Mugshot is here, that's right, and tomorrow...
Come here, big tits!
Tomorrow, Daddy's supposed to go turn himself in, so who knows what lifted mugshot we might get there.
It's good stuff.
The G1 has come and gone. Another great G1 in the books. A somewhat surprising G1 in a few ways for sure. Mostly welcome surprises. If for WWE, SummerSlam has come and gone. We're speeding towards one of the largest wrestling shows ever put together in All In at Wembley Stadium, where over 80,000 people are going to be gathered to watch a card that comes with some controversy, you know, but we're at an interesting point of wrestling where there is a lot of big shit happening kind of across the world right now. I think it would be best to just very quickly talk about WWE here. Not so much to rehash SummerSlam, but as we like to do with WWE, you know, sometimes it's good to pop in every couple weeks, every couple months, and just how are we feeling about what we're doing in WWE? For my money, WWE is, I'd say we're probably operating at about like 50% good, 50% bad right now, with most of the good coming really in the mid card more than anywhere else. But with a few noteworthy things happening at the top of the card. So the most notable things we've got going on right now is that Jey Uso appears to have left WWE after his brother turned on him and Roman Reigns was able to keep the WWE Universal Championship undisputed, united, red and blue, but also black belts, with yet another distraction. Jimmy said that he wanted to stop Jay from turning into Roman, and then Jay said, fuck this, I'm leaving. So that's, you know, the problem with Bloodline stories is exactly what we said after Mania, which is, I don't feel like we needed this to have the belt. And it's dominated the top of the card now for so long. And with it being all but written in stone that Cody Rhodes has to be the person to dethrone Roman and it must be at WrestleMania next year, this is where I think WWE is hitting some weak spots right now, is that I understand that we've had multiple points where we've been like the Bloodline stories on its last legs, but there was always something to kind of prop it up. Sammy, we now look back at that story differently, but we forget that Sammy is the reason why we were okay with another 6+ months of Bloodline stories, especially because it felt like it had a conclusive ending that we were going to get to, and we didn't get that. And now we're doing family drama that is frankly not interesting enough to dominate this much of the card. Ryan, are we in agreement? Or do we disagree?
I would say 50-50. You know, I will allow myself to wait and be patient. We've been patient long enough with this. Obviously, the notion to attach a belt to a storyline is very significant with WWE. We could have had Cody win at WrestleMania and then the fallout continue with, you know, did we need the belt attached to SummerSlam? No, but this is what we got. I will say this, though. I am approaching territory in WWE where I have no idea what's going to happen next. You know, many, many times in the last decade plus, us being smarks, we knew what, we didn't necessarily know what was going to happen, but we always used to get little tidbits here and there in like June of, you know, Meltzer saying this is going to be the WrestleMania match the next year. And if you put the pieces together correctly, you knew what was going to happen. I really don't know what's going to happen. And I kind of like that aspect of it, you know? Because you have different elements at play here, right? You have how is Cody going to get interjected to this? What's going to happen with Jay? You know, it would be absolutely wild if they somehow worked out a deal and Jay showed up on Sunday just for like one, just to appear on camera and be like, oh yeah, you know, you need me? Well, I'm here.
If they like cut a side deal with AEW.
Yeah, just for like an appearance or something like that. Like, you know, just a tease. Like, I don't need WWE. It's like, where are they going to go with that? You know?
Well,
is Jimmy's feud with Jay separate from, like, does he still hate Roman? But this is just some brotherly feud.
That's what it seems to be, being that Jimmy's whole thing was like, I don't want you turning into Roman. Like, I'm glad that they at least had enough respect for the fans and the performers and the storyline to not just have Jimmy go back to Roman for like no fucking reason whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like, I can live with that. But I don't feel as confident as you that I don't know where this is going, because it really does feel preordained that it has to be Cody and he's got to be the one to take it off. And then it makes you feel like he's got to be the one to win the Rumble. And the only wrinkle here is what happens with the new title. But,
well, you could certainly say that, but you can also say, let me ask you this. Do you entrust it more in the hands of Triple H right now than you would Vince? Separate Triple H from, like, if it was just still Vince's reign and they were going with these moves.
Like, yes, probably, ultimately.
I think there's still enough things at play here to where, yeah, we know what's going to happen. But, you know, for example, Jay mentioned in an interview before SummerSlam, I would love to wrestle Jimmy at WrestleMania and, you know, the Monkey Paw Colonels.
Yeah.
Is that what we're going to get, you know? And then you have Solo in here too now. And I think he needs a little more I think he needs a little more polishing, but he's certainly a player at hand here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we got to see how it plays out. But where WWE is doing some things right here, like I said, is in the mid card and the upper mid card. You know, I guess I don't know to what degree everybody or like more casual fans necessarily agree. But for my money, Gunther's Intercontinental title reign is, well, first off, we're under 30 days now from him breaking Honky Tonk's record.
Which let's pause for a second and discuss how they did right by this guy. He debuted NXT UK. We were all not worried, but we were just like, where is this going to go? And a lot of it was from Walter's perspective, because he was really set on being a Dory Funk. You know, he really, I think, loved the fact of training people, being Eurocentric to his work. Didn't want to move to Florida to work NXT. But I think once, you know, whether who was in his ear, if it was Vince or Triple H, you know, just come over here and we'll work it out. A completely transformative person in the wrestling industry right now. Let's shed 100 pounds and become an entirely different being of the industry, you know, just another chapter in his career. They did right by him. And the most important thing is that the Intercontinental title is attached to him right now.
Yes.
And we have that mid-card aspect to it, to where we can view this. We're not beholden to just the championship. We now have its own sphere of the Intercontinental Championship. What's going on with him right now? Did you see Monday?
So I didn't watch the match with Gable, but my understanding is that we are finally letting Gable do what he should have been able to do the whole time, which is be one of the best wrestlers in the world.
Such a shame, you know? He's luckily still young to where Shorty Jordan afflict him.
Him and Jordan can't be more than like early 30s, right?
Our age?
Oh, no. Gable's 37.
Okay, but still, like, you know,
he's not like 45 or
whatever. But right, you know, I mean, like, think of Angle at 37 versus Gable.
Yeah,
I just listen, Monday, if anybody watched, was fantastic. And kudos to Jason Jordan for producing that match, by the way.
Kurt Angle, when he was 37, had like just started the wrestling machine and then went to TNA and proceeded to have the best shit of his career. So absolutely, like, and this is a modern era where 37 is not this. He's not a hard 37 by any means.
Well, we also view things from particularly the perspective of the athlete in the modern day. Like people will point to like the NFL, like, you know, if you're 30 in the NFL, you're either a quarterback or you're a superstar, and there's not many in between. But in wrestling, it's different. Like, people always point to Finn Balor's age, but that man definitely has at least another 10 years on him. If everything goes correctly.
But point being is that Gunther is somebody that I am happy to be wrong about. I was very vocally against the name change. It has been fine. I was unsure about how they were going to treat him on the main roster. He's been treated as one of the most strongly booked and well-booked people of modern memory. I feel like a big reason for this, also, here's something interesting. Gunther's actually younger than Chad Gable, so that's kind of interesting.
How old is he?
He's 36.
Okay.
One year. Gotten right about Gunther is everything that made him the spectacle he was in Europe and then on the Indies has remained. He is huge. He's powerful. He's brutal. He's effective. He doesn't have one finisher. He beats people with just regular degular moves just by wearing them down. And Imperium is, in a lot of ways, a perfect heel stable because you don't like them. They're pretentious. They're vaguely fascist. They're like...
Yeah, we can be honest here.
They're everything you hate in a heel. But he does not... And like, Imperium does villainry stuff. They jump people. They do whatever. But by and large, his defenses are one-on-one affairs. He is an extremely well-booked villain, where the reason he's a villain is because he is extremely dismissive. He's cold. He's brutal. He's effective. And I do think that you got to give full marks to WWE for getting this right. And the body transformation he gave himself easily added 10 years to his career. Listen, no disrespect to the Honk Man here, but Honky Tonk was... it was weird for him to have had that record for as long as he did. Like, I feel like everything that people feel like Jeff Jarrett is actually what Honky Tonk was. Like, every time somebody was like, Jeff Jarrett's like some mid-carder that shouldn't be anywhere near the top of the card, and why would you put him there? I feel like that's like actually what Honky Tonk Man was.
I'll give a little more respect to Jeff Jarrett, but I always...
Well, no, that's what I'm saying is...
Right.
Is Jeff... everything that people bitch about Jeff Jarrett having been, I feel like is actually what Honky Tonk Man was. Jarrett is better than that.
Yeah, I always wondered what the placating aspect to Honky Tonk's run was, you know? Because by all aspects, like, you know, Vince didn't necessarily have an appreciation for Southern wrestling, whether it was a means to an end and he was a definable character, if that's what his longevity was with the IC title. But yeah, you know, no disrespect to Honky Tonk Man, but also, like, if you asked him today, like, I think he'd be okay with Gunther achieving the title here.
It's especially because the Intercontinental Championship in a lot of ways has always kind of been looked at as the working man's belt,
yep.
The workhorse yep. belt.
And you just, like, you get encapsulated in, like, the separation from the main card and, like, WWE. It really feels like you're watching a territory match when Gunther steps into the ring. One interesting element I noticed was last week, Otis faced him, and, like, Otis was able to, you know, escape out of that character because he knew, like, oh shit, I have to turn it to 11 when I'm facing this guy here. And that's the beauty of Gunther's reign, is that he's bringing out the brawler aspect of these wrestlers. He's bringing out the working aspect of these wrestlers. It's not like I can't just work on character alone here. I have to devise a plan to beat this monster that I'm facing. And that's just the beauty behind it. And the greatest IC reigns, you know, in the last 20 years have been that, you know, even Miz, when he had his reigns, you know, you had to have a cunning aspect to him to defeat it.
I guess, like, the thing you can say about Honky Tonk is that he was very good at being disliked. And so that yeah. made him effective. You know, he was an extremely effective heel.
That's fair.
You know, like, I understand I'm being a little dismissive to a Hall of Famer here. I understand that. But my point really is that a title that has the prestige of the Intercontinental Championship, it never sat right with me that Honky Tonk Man was the guy sitting at the top of the charts here. And
also, it's to the degree of, does WWE want to give the time of day to that reign? And luckily, yeah. whether it's them, which is, it's kind of apparent at this point that this is now a definitive line in the sand for WWE. They want to establish themselves in the new generation, which I think they've done a fantastic job at in the last 2 years. They don't want to hearken back to, whether or not me and you like this, they don't want to hearken back to Bruno Sammartino. then I'm going to harken back to Macho Man and Honky Tonk Man. They want to harken back to 10 years, 15 years, mm-hmm. 20 years down the line. They can look at these reigns.
Absolutely.
And, no pun intended, you know, with Roman Reigns, they want to look, they're going to look back, like, so how we viewed ourselves as fans in 2016, we kind of harkened back to CM Punk's reign, right? Or yeah. Brock Lesnar's reign. You know, they want to have a moment to where, oh, I'm going to look to Roman Reigns' reign. I'm going to look to Gunther's reign.
Mm-hmm.
I think some work needs with the U.S. belt, but hey, listen, one of the aspects we were clamoring for was, you know, get these belts up to where they deserve to be. If you're going to have them, if you're going to have, you know, two shows a week of weekly television, have two weekly TV titles, you know.
This is exactly something we've been saying for years, and WWE here with this reign has established the Intercontinental Championship as, you know, in a lot of ways what Miz always wanted it to be. He said, you know, must see TV. A Gunther match is must see TV. Whether somebody takes this title off of him is must see TV. And the brilliance of this is that there are no clear cut people that for sure will take this off of him. It could be anyone from Chad Gable to fucking Finn Balor to to Brock Lesnar at this point. Like his reign has been one defined by just incredible match after incredible match. I would say probably the defining feud there is like him and Sheamus, you know, and the Brutes are like him and Drew, but
I'd say him and Sheamus have, Sheamus and John Cena have the veteran aspect to it of like they need this title to complete their litany of championships. But that's what I was speaking to before with WWE is like, you know, not only do you not know what's going to happen next with the championship scene, but like, you know, with the IC scene and other things going on, like with Judgment Day and, you know, interesting things like that is like, you know, this is what we wanted for years was this like, let's work up in our heads and, you know, be a mark and like, you know, what's going to come next. And I think whether or not we like the path of getting there, we are now asking those questions. And I think that's a very brilliant element of Triple H's reign right now.
Yeah. You know, but a weak spot again, good, bad. So we've got the top of the card looking eh. Seth's story has, you know, I mean, Seth's championship reign from a match quality perspective has been great. Judgment Day has been fantastic. I'm not a huge fan of the idea of breaking them up right now. That seems premature, but we shall see what happens with that. It's at least compelling for the moment. Dom being NXT.
Great, great interjection of that because, you know,
Dom being North American champion. I mean, Dom really is the most disliked person in America. My God.
What a transformation. That boy has done good, man.
He is.
He is getting under the wings of the right people. He's doing great. And, you know, one thing I wanted to say, too, is like with the Judgment Day is that like they're all doing their own paths. You know, Rhea's champion.
But Rhea's booking has been the weak point here because they've built her up to be like too. She's like. They built her up to be somebody that is too strong for the rest of the division to go after because it's been squash after squash after squash. It's very like...
Is that because you're equating it to where she is now achieving like China territory of where
we
like,
are absolutely in that territory of like, you're not even really giving people shots against her. Like it's... And also WWE is still afraid to like let a man and a woman tussle in the ring. So it's also in this weird spot where she's taking as a credible threat, but also no one's touching her. So I don't know. It's
separating itself from that. There's definitely an argument to be made of who else is on her level, but at the end of the day, as long as it's not Charlotte, I think they can certainly build up someone to defeat her. But no, I completely agree. She's on her own plane of existence, right?
And the women's
division is a TikTok star.
Yes.
She's a pop culture star. And that's where WWE struggles, you know, because
she's a big deal.
Their ultimate worry is that they're going to become too larger for WWE. But
yeah.
they've at least, you know, encapsulated her to where she is a WWE star.
The women's division has been kind of hit or miss. You know, SummerSlam showed that. First off, cutting off Becky and Trish entirely.
Which I'm asking, that's
real a fucking weird decision.
A thumbs down to that. And I know people are pointing out, Trish had such a good run, and then she had that one bad match on Raw, either this week or last week. And like, it's like you're really going to affect that on the run so far. Like, she's just been absolutely great, and we should appreciate our time with her.
Becky Lynch being left off of SummerSlam is just what the fuck are you doing? Yeah, why do you have her in the company?
Certainly, as we said, someone who does not know how to a company does not know how to handle someone being on a different plane. Doesn't really need WWE, you know. No, I'm not saying she's going to be in the next Fast and Furious movie, but she's definitely been vocal on how, like, hey, listen, I'm fucking big. Like, you got
to
use me.
No, she's too big to be left off of SummerSlam. It's unreal. You know, the triple threat didn't work out great. Io being on top is very cool. Damage control is over. So, you know, I feel like overall the point here is WWE, they're in a weird place. You know, they're in a weird place. We're not quite at the halfway mark of, you know, Mania yet, but we're approaching the end of the year. We're getting there. We're starting to get into Rumble territory sooner rather than later. And it's hard for me to tell how I feel about WWE overall. There's some good, there's some bad, there's a little bit of something for everybody. It's not a train wreck. It's not the heights it was hitting Mania season last year. This is in an interesting juxtaposition to AEW.
I just want to discuss one thing first, though.
Yes.
Edge.
So leading to AEW, the big thing here is Edge revealed that his contract was up at the end of September. He had a match against Sheamus last week on SmackDown, which was a predictable banger, of course. In Toronto, he went over, he cut a little heartfelt promo, and then he left, and nobody knows what's happening. Well, the rumor now, and listen, the dirt sheets are not in a great spot right now when it comes to credibility. I know that it's arguable whether they ever have been, but they've gotten a lot of shit wrong lately. However, the news coming out right now is that Edge is not going to be re-signing with WWE because WWE may have decided to pass on re-signing him. If you believe the stories go that Edge went to WWE, said, this is the number I want, this is what I'm thinking, and they said, I'm good. The reason why this is maybe a little bit more credible than other standard contract negotiation shit, especially with somebody like Edge, is aside from the fact that, you know, he's 50 and his neck and blah, 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 blah. The fact that WWE now belongs to Endeavor means that they may not necessarily be willing to shell out big bucks for aging stars or people they don't view as moneymakers anymore. This is now spiraling with the rumors that Edge has been interested in a reunion with Christian and AEW. And all of this is leading to Sunday, where the first All-In, you know, the first All-In since the last All-In, since the All-In in 2017 that is single-handedly responsible for AEW's existence, is being held at Wembley Stadium in front of 80,000 people. It is, to my recollection, in the top three highest gate wrestling events of all time.
Think back to our first episode, dude. Imagine, because we were at the first month of AEW on our first episode. Imagine telling yourself they're going to sell out Wembley Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where people have to realize, like, the card, whatever, I don't care. Like, the industry has been so hot right now. So hot.
Absolutely massive. So to put this in perspective here, All In has 100% sold more than WrestleMania 32. WrestleMania 32's marketed attendance was 101,763. Dave Meltzer explained that those numbers kind of include like any person near the stadium, vendors, blah, 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 blah. But the actual attendance was 80,709. All In has surpassed that. The only event bigger than that is Collision in Korea in Pyongyang, which is like 100
forced to attend.
And it was like 150,000, but also who the fuck knows what it actually was. You have no idea.
Clap for Ric Flair.
So, in all likelihood, All In is, for all intents and purposes, the largest show ever put on. And all of this in a short 5 years from the first All In and only 4 years after AEW was created. It is a and all of this was done really without a card.
Yeah, that too.
Now, the double-edged sword of this is that the card, arguably, depending on how you feel about such things and how you what you think is the thing you want to see at something like an event like this, it doesn't necessarily live up. However, this is not to suggest that it is by any means not a strong card. It's headlined by MJF versus Adam Cole, where Better Than You, Bebe is one of the hottest things in the industry right
now.
Yeah,
I will take a step back and say, like, I was like, oh, wow, they're running the
Adam Cole. Oh, can they MJF coexist?
No, it's been great.
Both of them have just really sold out for this.
Who's going to turn on who?
It's brilliant. It's beautiful. MJF as a, you know, he's our dirtbag thing has been great. You know, you've got Punk versus Samoa Joe, which, to be honest, I'm not even interested in talking about Punk's shenanigans in AEW right now.
Oh God. Yeah, no, I don't.
All I really have to say about it is that Tony Khan should have just left it where the fuck it was and let everybody move on with their lives instead of instead of giving him his own fucking TV show, but whatever.
It's horrible.
You're going to get him versus Samoa Joe for the real world championship.
Real.
Will Ospreay versus Chris Jericho, easily the most divisive match on here. I am not sitting here telling you Chris Jericho shouldn't be on this card. Mm-hmm. I am telling you that Will Ospreay, pretty easily the best wrestler in the world, should not be having a singles match with Chris Jericho here. And at this point, I can't even understand the star power argument of it. Like, well,
I hate to say it, it's Chris Jericho. And we've gone back and forth on this. I understand. It's not the match I want either, but I will give the credence to Chris. Let's see what he does in this match.
I mean, it doesn't matter what he does, because Will Ospreay is literally the best wrestler in the world. I'm sure it'll be an incredible match, but it's just...
Well, the problem with this card is that we have a fucking pay-per-view a week later.
Yeah, and also, Will Ospreay is like shitbag heel with Don Callis, except he's so fucking over and they're doing it in his home country. But they're Jericho be the face.
No, yes, you're correct on that, but also, who else are they going to get to face Ospreay right now? That's not Kenny.
Zack Sabre Jr.
Not
the Battle of England.
Yeah.
If you don't want it to be Kenny Omega, have it be Kota Ibushi. You don't want it to be Kota Ibushi, have it be Jay.
Well, the answer here is fucking dumbass real world championship. Should have been CM Punk versus.
Yeah, whatever. It's the match will be incredible. Ospreay deserves it. Give Jericho his flowers. Jericho announced he's going to play himself out with Fozzy. So, like, congratulations. Oh, Fozzy sold. I can't wait to see that on fucking t-shirts. Chris Jericho talking about how he sold out the Wembley fucking city.
Oh, boy. Yep.
The most interesting match that you've got here, really, is you got the Golden Elite, Kota Ibushi, Kenny Omega, and Hangman Adam Page versus Konosuke Takeshita and Bullet Club Gold, Juice Robinson, and Jay White. This is a match with layers on layers on layers. Takeshita idolizing Kota Ibushi and Omega and coming from their home promotion of DDT. Jay White being the person that first took the U.S. title off of Kenny Omega and then supplanted him in Bullet Club. Jay White, arguably Kota Ibushi's biggest villain in New Japan. Hangman Adam Page, Jay White's first contender for the U.S. title after he took it off of Kenny, where Jay White absolutely destroyed him. Juice Robinson, synonymous in a lot of ways with the U.S. title, lost against Kenny and then beat him in the G1 back when he was in New Japan. So there's a lot of great layers in this match.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because for Juice, it's fine to establish himself as a American star here. For Hangman, it's finally able to get himself back up to that level where he should have been.
Yep.
Fuck CM Punk. Jesus.
Yeah,
Christ.
And also, I
can't believe, like, we talked about this too, and it was a definitive moment where we were watching, I think it was Revolution, where the AEW Cryon at the bottom with the graphics team is like, we're proud of you, Hank. Like, this should be your premier star right here. Also, to anybody that was kind of disappointed with Bushi in the Blood and Guts match, this is
going to be,
and that's fine. I'm not disagreeing with that, but like, this will be his definitive moment here.
Yes, he is either, because here's the thing, he showed up to Blood and Guts looking, I mean, listen, to your point earlier, I am in no position to call Kota Ibushi out of shape. However,
it was an awkward match to place him in.
He was not in his ring shape. He was not in his typical ring shape, even with the caveat that his usual ring shape is like an unobtainable standard. But also, apparently, he like wore shoes that were too thin. Nobody warned him there were going to be tacks all over the place, and that does kind of explain his kicks having no snap. So
this is
a perfect spot for him. It's a six-man tag. It'll be frenetic. It will be with people he's worked with extensively. It's in an environment that suits him. Like, I fully expect him to be the Ibushi of old. Darby Allin and Sting versus Mogul Embassy. I mean, Mogul Embassy, Swerve with AR
Joker
Fox.
Sting.
Really, really feels big. Joker Sting. Sting getting to be on this card is very cool.
Talk about second acts earlier. Like, I know Sting alluded to this being his last year, but I refuse to believe that man to leave anytime soon.
And I would like to point out, Sting was not on the Collision in Korea match, despite it being squarely in Sting's WCW reign. So now for him to be able to compete in front of 80,000+ people is incredible. It's so cool. I'm sure this match will be great. Hikaru Shida versus Toni Storm versus Saraya versus Britt Baker. The women's division in AEW is a fucking disaster. I mean, whatever you want to say about the women's division in WWE, it's worse than AEW, but the match should be good.
Get Saraya out of here and play someone else in there. I like this. Yeah, I like this.
Honestly.
But it's at least a four-way.
Yes.
There's some elements to it.
Yeah, everyone will be fine. FTR versus the Bucks. I mean, listen, the matchup works. You go back to where the money is. And in Aussie Open...
We're not going to talk about it.
Oh, well, what's there to talk about, you know? It's just Cash Wheeler casually whipping guns out in traffic a week before the literal largest wrestling event of all time.
No big deal. You think Papa Khan had some plays in here?
Oh, yeah. He had no travel restrictions. Really? That's super interesting. I wonder if I'd have no travel restrictions. Yeah. And then Aussie Open versus MJF and Cole, who are going for the Ring of Honor Tag Team Championships before their main event.
Well,
I mean,
that's definitely going to have some play into their final match.
I love it. So, like I said, the card is...
Oh, the Stadium Stampede, too.
Oh, and the Stadium Stampede. That's right. Big old Stadium Stampede. Eddie Kingston, best friends, Penta El Zero Miedo, and unfortunately not Ray Fenix, who is, again, having visa issues, versus Blackpool Combat Club, John Moxley, Claudio Castagnoli, Wheeler Yuta, and three other people to be A's.
I am very cool with the idea of Chris Statlander and Mercedes Martinez being interjected into that somehow, and kind of Mercedes being the female oppo of the Blackpool Combat Club.
That would be very cool. This is complete fantasy booking, but I would love if Best Friends called in the favor and got Okada in this match.
Hell yeah. Oh my God.
Call in the Chaos Connection and bring out Okada. I of course that won't happen, but you know, a man can dream. But so even with the match, even with the card, maybe in some ways feeling like, shouldn't it be bigger? Ultimately, they're giving you basically every big star in AEW with really like a litany of fantastic matches. And
it's fine. You have to separate yourself from the element of AEW has no storylines.
Also Jay White now actually gets to say, because as part of his thousand things, he says, the man who single-handedly sold out Madison Square Garden and the United Center and Wembley Stadium. It'll be great. So AEW, I mean, who the fuck knows what All Out's going to be like. And so AEW is a hodgepodge, but the simple fact of this match, of this event happening, I mean, it would take a lot for it to be anything other than an outrageous success and the ultimate fuck you to anybody that thought it wasn't possible to do this in 2023. It's, you know, we say it all the time, it's a great time to be a wrestling fan. It really is. It's very interesting stuff. And shit like this forces WWE to take notice and care. If you think they aren't bothered by the fact that AEW has outsold any event they've ever put on now and did it with almost no card, if you don't think something like that is rustling all of the jimmies, you're wrong.
Yeah, and I hate the notion of people on Twitter like, you didn't have any card. No, listen. I don't care if you don't like AEW. Love this for the business.
Absolute. This is big. This is a big deal.
This is what we've been dreaming about since our first episode. This is what we've been dreaming about since the end of the Silver Era with the Indies into 2016, AJ Styles debuting in WWE. We've been wanting this for a while. And if this is your first, you know, appearance in the wrestling scene, you are coming across maybe even something greater than the Attitude Era, dare I say.
I think in a lot of ways, this is... it's unique. It's a unique time in wrestling.
You also have to understand the aspect of, you know, the Eurocentric aspect to it, of where English fans and UK fans have been starved in a way and ignored to an important aspect of wrestling history. They are finally getting their show.
And if you don't think that BritWrest fans aren't also going to this in spite of WWE for feeling that NXT UK decimated BritWrest as a fucking countrywide industry, you know, you're sadly mistaken. Not only is the crowd going to be massive, but it is going to be electric. Absolutely electric. This is going to be an atmosphere quite unlike maybe anything we've seen before. It is historic, and it really doesn't matter if you hate every single person on this roster. This is a success for wrestling, just like it is a success for wrestling for WWE to go to India, just like it is a success for them to go to Saudi Arabia. Shit like this is important to the industry.
I'll say this, and let me know if you agree with me. We have WrestleMania next year in Philadelphia. The year after is rumored to believe to be Minneapolis. But do you think this finally forces a hand to do a WrestleMania UK?
They strongly hinted Cena. They had Cena go out there and talk about how it would be cool to run WrestleMania in London. Let me tell you something, folks. John Cena don't just say shit like that.
If get out somebody there, pal.
Listen, I get it.
Cena, pal.
Cena can say whatever he wants, but I'm telling you, Cena's saying shit like that for a reason. 100%. Something like this shows WWE that not only is there a market there, but there is a market dying for big time wrestling. Not just clubs, not just small venues. They are desperate for big time wrestling. It, you know, and Clash at the Castle was a huge fucking success for them in the UK as a whole. Abso-fucking-lutely, this is going to make them consider that strongly. And guess what? If they run WrestleMania in the UK, that's a good fucking thing. More wrestling fans across the world is a good thing.
WrestleMania 2 p.m. in the afternoon on Sunday.
Oh, stop it.
They don't even need to do two nights. Just do it at 2 p.m. I'll watch all the way.
You can go for 12 hours. Doesn't matter to me, man. It is truly something special. And so this is what time does it say? I think that says 6 p.m. Is that 6 p.m. Greenwich time, I believe?
It's 2 p.m. It's starting 2 p.m.
It's 2 p.m. here.
And shit will kick in around 5 p.m. for us.
Are you going to the wedding on Saturday?
I am.
You and Kelly are going?
Mm-hmm.
Great. So we all do that. We go have a great time, and then we can watch wrestling. Sounds great.
There we go.
Gina's supposed to go to Long Beach and see... She's supposed to go to Wanta and see Alana and Travis. I might have to... But, well, actually, Travis will probably have it on. Whatever. We'll talk.
Tell
So all in all, there's big things, not just stateside, but countrywide as well. And similarly, New Japan is now officially in the long winding road to Wrestle Kingdom. The G1 23 is behind us. Your winner for this year for the third time, Tetsuya Naito at 41 years old. The world had counted Naito out. Sonata had left him.
The world is a Naito.
His pareja in Evil left him high and dry. Sonata abandoned him. Hiromu thinks himself the ace. Yoda Tsuji comes in, the hot new ticket that's going to take over LIJ. But when the chips were down, it was Tetsuya Naito's time. Now, first off, I could do an episode alone on the G1 as a whole, but what I'll say is the G1 this year, it was four blocks, a little unique in that each block had a clear-cut winner, but also people vying for second place in the block. So you had quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals to get to the actual G1 finals. There were a lot of eye-opening and star-making performances here for the G1. I'm sorry, this is 33, not 32. A lot of eye-opening performances for a lot of people here. First off, El Fantasmo absolutely showing that he belongs in the heavyweight division and having a match of the year candidate with Will Ospreay. Will Ospreay just continuing to be the best wrestler in the world. The War Dogs of Gabe Kidd and Alex Coughlin showing that Bullet Club is just fine. Tongaloa and Kenta, as well as Tongaloa and Okada having maybe the worst match I've ever seen in my life. I am not somebody that dislikes Tongaloa, but oh boy, did he make me look fucking stupid.
Was it the...
Did you see the chop?
I did not.
There's a gif going around of Tongaloa's offense where he's trying to emulate his dear papa Haku, where he does the chop neck thing. But yeah, they are the softest tippy taps you've ever seen. They are really embarrassing.
Not good.
It's really, really bad.
It's not good, folks.
Okada, real angry at all the young boys. The
Wow, I love that he carried that element since the
Reiwa
Okada.
The Reiwa Musketeers, Yoda Tsuji, Shota Umino, and Ren Narita showing that they are indeed the future. Ren Narita comes out looking like he really needs to figure out how to be more than just Shibata Jr. But Shota Umino really helped elevate himself in his tournament. Yoda Tsuji continues to look like an absolute star. Eddie Kingston got himself real over with the Japanese crowd and got to meet Toshiaki Kawada, and now is getting to interview Toshiaki Kawada for StarCast. And like, boy, is he just living the best.
I never put two and two together on why he wears the black pants with the yellow shirt.
There you go. Toshiaki Kawada. You know, so Eddie Kingston having a real, real great run there as strong champion. Shane Haste and Mikey Nichols, TMDK, showing that they are not just the arm candy for Zack Sabre Jr. Zack Sabre Jr., again, is the best tournament wrestler in the world. But I would say that the people that have benefited most, aside from the new Musketeers, is really the War Dogs. Hikuleo actually won out the A block. You know, Hikuleo's got a bright future ahead of him, possibly brighter than Tama and Tangaloa. Bullet Club looks like it's in good hands, other David Finlay. And Aaron Hinari was a real standout in this tournament as well, which is well deserved. It was an overall very strong tournament for just about everybody. Although one thing that is also very apparent from the G1 this year is that it pains me to say this, but Hiroshi Tanahashi should not be doing the G1 anymore. He can barely move. He is too proud, too stubborn to take the time off he desperately needs to heal up his knees. There's no stem cells in his future. And Tana talked about modifying his style. He had a grappling match with ZSJ that showed that maybe he was going to start changing shit up. But he kept going for the high-fi flows. And he just, listen, man, 47 years on those knees.
47, oh my God.
47. Hiroshi Tanahashi is an absolute hero of mine. He's a megastar the world round. I don't think he can be at this level anymore, though. And it really, I don't think, like, I know it was painfully clear. He was a weak point every time he was in the ring. And that is not what Hiroshi Tanahashi should be to anybody. And if he's not willing to modify his style, like his mentor, Keiji Muto, then he cannot have the longevity of his mentor, Keiji Muto. I
WWE run.
I can't even think about how badly they wouldn't know what to do with him. You think Nakamura's bad?
Put on the ninja mask, pal. Get out there.
What do you use? Used to be a tiger mask, right? You used to walk around with a tiger mask. But the finals, however. Evil got out of his block because Gato hates us all, but Okada put the House of Torture right where they belong in the goddamn trash. Will Ospreay and Tetsuya Naito in the semifinals put on one of the best matches you'll ever see. Will Ospreay appears to legitimately knock out Naito at one point, and Naito has to be literally carried to the finish. Everybody was like, he is concussed. He should not be going out there the next night. But that don't stop Tetsuya Naito, and Tetsuya Naito went out and had another bell-to-bell classic with rival Kazuchika Okada, just another chapter in one of the greatest rivalries in professional wrestling history. Tetsuya Naito and Okada knowing each other so well, dodging each other's moves, not letting each other get their shit off. The crowd also... I mean, this is the first G1, I think, with full cheering crowds. And if there is one thing that is clear, it is that if you, as a stupid Westerner, were like, oh, you know, Naito came out at Forbidden Door, a t-shirt, and nobody cares about him anymore. Nah, nah, nah. Well, let me tell you something. Japan got something to say about that because they were electric.
I actually watched this. Absolutely
electric for Tetsuya Naito.
This was my the first God. Definitive... You can argue Kenny versus Ospreay or anything at Wrestle Kingdom, but to me, this is the first definitive welcome back moment of the
Wrestle Kingdom Western was crowd. Big, absolutely, but this was my good golly goodness. This was just something special. The match was fantastic. For Ryan and Maya's money, I wouldn't consider it. Neither of us would consider it our favorites. My personal favorite, their match at Wrestle Kingdom 14 or 15, the double gold dash where Naito finally beats Okada for the heavyweight title on his own, would be my personal pick. And Ryan, I believe you said a different one of their matches was your pick. But it was an absolutely stellar match, and the crowd was just, I mean, I have not heard the crowd that loud in a long time.
It was almost like a soft reset. We hope that, because we've attached New Japan to AEW the last 2 years, and it's kind of been like, you know, two Forbidden Doors have been awesome, but it's kind of like, in the handshake deal, where is it coming to New Japan? Not that New Japan needs AEW at all, don't get me wrong, but in the modern sense of viewership and clamoring for the product, I think they finally got back to square one here. That, and listen, that's to Japan doing the right thing in a lot of aspects with their crowd, but I think we're finally able to steer the ship in the direction of where, you know, we can now focus on New Japan as to what it should be. You know, the same aspect that we just discussed with WWE, with AEW, we can now discuss New Japan moving forward.
The president of Bushiroad gave a very candid interview answer recently when asked about the state of New Japan of America, and said, realistically, we can't compete with a company like AEW existing as well. The partnership has been good for both companies, but there is a clear winner in who it's more beneficial for, especially from an eyes on product situation. Part of that, frankly, is because all of the Excalibur love and lore does not make up for the fact that AEW just does not present New Japan stars the way that they need to. That just is what it is. It's,
you know, it shouldn't be on them to that aspect as well, but as long as New Japan does a MGM Arena match in Las Vegas,
which they have coming up, yes. Absolutely. You know,
and if they present it in the right way, sell out 100%.
Well, what the G1 made clear is that the domestic product is getting back to pre-COVID levels slowly but surely. Probably the biggest standout of the G1 was Kaito Kiyomiya, the young ace of Pro Wrestling Noah. Kaito Kiyomiya is actually on the younger side with the rest of the Musketeers, and will be taking Ryohei Oiwa, a young lion, back with him to Noah. But he did not make it out of his block. It was a questionable booking decision to not give him a match against Okada. However, it's clear that everybody in New Japan values him, and it remains to be seen if Noah values him the way they need to. Noah cannot afford to lose Kaito Kiyomiya, and absolutely could. It would be a massive blow to them and a huge get for New Japan. But New Japan cannot realistically get that foothold in America for as long as AEW exists. They are better off kind of settling into their niche and really continuing to focus on the domestic product while, you know, still trying to get that global audience with their partnership with CMLL and partnerships with AEW and Impact, Multiverse United. Their most recent crossover event with Impact was a big success, and saw Takahashi actually take a loss to Speedball Mike Bailey, I believe, or Leo Rush. I forget which one pinned him. But New Japan is in a, I feel from a creative perspective, New Japan is in a good place right now. Sanada has been a solid champion. He is clearly going to be treated with respect moving forward. All of this is likely leading to Naito versus Sanada. So Naito will get that win most likely at Wrestle Kingdom. No one ever wins their first Wrestle Kingdom defense of the title. It's just how it works. Naito will get his flowers as he so rightfully deserves, get the roll call that was denied to him. The Musketeers will continue to grow in. You've got younger talent in the Bullet Club War Dogs kind of starting to ascend to that higher Gaijin mantle while you've still got Will Ospreay at the absolute top of his game. Remains to be seen if people like ZSJ and Ospreay will remain around or whether they will defect to AEW, but we'll cross that bridge when he comes to it. All of this is to say that we are now in the home stretch of the New Japan schedule, which means really all we've got left is we've got the Destruction tours. Destruction in Kobe, September 24th, and Destruction in Ryogoku, October 9th. A couple of interesting matches that we've got going on here. Not everything's announced, but Destruction in Kobe will see the top of the card as Will Ospreay versus Yota Tsuji for the U.S., which is now the U.K. Heavyweight Championship. Tetsuya Naito versus Jeff Cobb, Shingo Takagi versus Great O'Connor. So a lot of these are you're seeing G1 feuds. Ospreay and Tsuji. Tsuji pinned Ospreay in a six-man. Naito and Cobb is because Cobb pinned Naito. Naito, notably, is not putting up any sort of G1 briefcase against Jeff Cobb, implying that we might have moved past that. Great O'Con promising to make Shingo Takagi lick his boots, that freaky motherfucker. Bishamon taking on TMDK, Shane Haste, and Mikey Nichols for the IWGP tag title. Taichi and Sho facing each other for the KOPW provisional title. A couple of tag matches, not particularly interesting. And then Destruction in Ryogoku, the top of the card, we'll see Sonata versus Evil. Sonata's lone loss in the tournament was against Evil. This could be an interesting match, but it probably won't be. David Finlay versus Tama Tonga for the Never Open Weight title, continuing Gorillas of Destiny versus Bullet Club. Similarly, the strong open weight tag team match will be Gabe Kidd and Alex Coughlin, the War Dogs against El Fantasmo and Hikuleo. You'll see a best of seven series final. You're going to see a best of seven series happening throughout the Road to Destruction tours between Master Wado, Shota Umino, and Yuji Nagata against El Desperado, Ren Narita, and Minoru Suzuki. Very curious to see why that's going on. You're going to get Tongaloa versus Chase Owens, which is a match absolutely nobody needed whatsoever. Don't ask me why it's happening. And the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title will be defended in a three-way as Hiromu takes on Leo Rush and Mike Bailey. Expect Takahashi to go over here as Takahashi is looking to overtake the V12 defenses Jushin Thunder Liger had the most defenses in a single juniors title reign. So Hiromu trying to break that record. So we got a couple months to solidify the Wrestle Kingdom tour and what the card will look like, but kind of just tying up some loose ends right now. But they also will have Royal Quest happening in the UK in October. They will be having a Vegas show, as Ryan alluded to, also in October, I believe. And that's kind of about it. That's kind of what New Japan's got going on as we get ourselves settled into Wrestle Kingdom, which will be going back to a one-night affair, it looks like, January 4th, 2024. That's my New Japan rundown.
There we go. We got through it, folks. Did it.
Thanks for your contribution, Ryan.
Hey.
So
I asked you what's going to go on in 6 months in New Japan.
Yeah, here you go.
Here's the question I always ask: What are the big events in between now and Wrestle Kingdom, Damian? All right, let me tell you for the fucking 18th time.
Fucking 45 of them. I don't know.
What's the Judgment Day of New Japan?
The Judgment Day of New Japan. Honestly, I don't. Probably just five guys. Because it's just a bunch of fucking dudes. It's just a bunch of people that are like, hey, you're cool. Hey, you know what?
No, I'm sorry. Not Judgment Day. What was the fucking old, like, I don't know. What's an old, like, what's the Armageddon of New Japan? What's the
Armageddon?
What's the No Mercy of New Japan?
what's the Retribution? Yeah, it's Destruction. These shows, the Destruction shows, can probably best be attributed to, like, I don't know, what's the show that usually happens before Mania? It's not just Royal Rumble.
Fastlane? What's the Fastlane? New Japan.
Yeah, there you go. These are the Fastlane shows. That's a good one. This is the Fastlane shows. We're just kind of getting shit set up. But so that's our rundown for wrestling happening, folks. It's been a long time. We've missed you all dearly, but we're back. Don't worry. Papas are here to kiss
Papas
you.
Papas are here.
Tuck you into bed and sing you sweet, sweet tales.
Where's my marquee?
Of the time Terry Funk pile-drived Ric Flair into an announce table.
My eye!
So as we wrap up here, Ryan, what have you been listening to lately?
So not necessarily what I've been listening to, but what I saw was SoGlo and MS Paint at the Massapequa VFW Hall exactly 1 week before I was married. And certainly it was quite a show to go out on as my freewheeling self. SoGlo is just, I have talked about them on here before. They are just a culmination of punk, metal, and hardcore all wrapped up into one fucking amazing product.
Yeah, that's right.
MS Paint is a... they call themselves post-American, which is fucking amazing. But you know, they have also just culminated, like, they are experimental hardcore from Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Fun.
Paul Malone has given them a shout out. That's the eclipse that they're working on. I had the pleasure of seeing also Queens of the Stone Age for the first time back.
Oh, and you were there also?
I was at the Bridgeport show, and I was also at the Forest Hill show.
Oh, very
and cool. Just like, there's not many rock bands like them left. And, you know, say what you want about Josh, but seriously, like...
I mean, Josh is a Tool, but that's a great band, right?
But
there.
He's kind of like his own Tool, you know, and I think he'd be the first person to tell you that.
Yeah.
But, you know... I'm just glad to have them back. You know, one of my favorite bands of all time. And coming up, I got Better Lovers. I'm going to see your favorite person of all time next week, Papa.
John Lennon?
Papa. Well, I mean, you may equate him to John Lennon, but I'll be seeing Papa Billy next week at Jones Beach.
Papa Billy?
Papa Billy.
Smashing Pumpkins?
The Pumps. Yes, the Pumps.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, boy. Are you going to bring a giant sign that says stop letting Tyrus beat his kids? If my kid comes home giving me my pronouns, my pronouns going to be ass whooping. Because all Tyrus can beat up is his own children. Take the goddamn belt off of him. Holy shit. Apparently NWA is running like a fucking title versus career match with EC3. Please do.
Who cares, dude?
Do what you need to do. Do what you need to do. My God.
But I'll also be seeing
Terry Crosses. Funk died for this.
I'll also be seeing Crosses at the end of November, too.
Oh, that's fun. I like Crosses, the side project of Chino Moreno.
So they're taking a different aspect from the last time they toured, which is like, oh my God, Jesus Christ, 2013, 14, to where Chino, like, they had a full band with Crosses, but now it Chino just really wants to go to the aspect of him and just kind of like an Atticus Finch, Trent Reznor kind of deal. So cool. I'm very excited to see what product they're going to turn out there.
Well, that should be neat. Yours truly has only seen two shows recently, but those are two shows worth seeing. Papa saw Metallica. Oh, yeah. MetLife Stadium. Pantera opened up for them. It's funny because I remember being a 12-year-old and being like, why is Zach Wilde just play for Pantera? I never understood that. And then here he is. It was very cool. Charlie Benante filling in as well for the Abbott brothers.
Listen, if you're gonna have two people fucking fill in, obviously,
yeah, it should be the guy from Anthrax and Zach Wilde. Yeah,
well, Zach Wilde is like, yeah, no, I mean, he fucking killed it. And my friend Scott was just like, oh, Zach Wilde's here, and I was like, if there's only one person, pinch harmonic, it's
yeah, fun. Yeah. I've literally said for decades, if it's going to be literally anybody, it should be Zach Wilde. So I'm glad that it happened. And they were great. I mean, hearing Walk sing by, like, you know, 50,000 people is definitely
cool. Yeah, it's invigorating.
But, you know, Metallica, just a bunch of old men just putting on fantastic shows on little donut stages. Lars's drum, like, moved throughout the stage, yeah, like, from place to place. And on the second night, I caught what was happening because they literally have four different drum sets set up and go under the stage.
Are you breaking kayfabe? Don't break Lars's kayfabe.
No, listen, Lars thought that he could do the fucking wrestling thing where you turn out all the lights and you're like, whoa, how'd he get behind it? That's so crazy. But here's the problem, folks. You're in an arena. The lights are everywhere. That's your fault. Don't make your staff use flashlights then. As for what I've been listening to, Ryan just mentioned them, but the Better Lovers EP, which came out a couple of weeks.
Did we talk about that?
No.
I think we did. No, we didn't.
No, we talked about the first single. EP was great. Great EP.
The EP was fucking fantastic. Such a gift.
That What's we were it able called?
What, 30 Under 30?
No, the EP itself. God Made Me an Animal.
Mm-hmm.
Teenage Wrist also put out a new album, which is great, but I've been feeling a little old school as of late, and so I like started going back and listening to a little bit of nu metal. So earlier I was listening to Bless the Martyr and Kiss the Child, Norma Jean.
Oh, wow, dude. Oh, my God.
Memphis will be metal. Laid to waste. So there's a lot of great metal happening out there, folks.
So on my way up to my bachelor party, I was listening.
If you're trying to talk, no one's hearing you, Ryan.
What?
If you're trying to talk, no one's hearing you. You can't not talk into the microphone.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Just don't talk out the side of your mouth. Yeah, sucking dog.
Anyway, Oh God, the Aftermath, which is, you know, not Josh album. Scogan, but just the successor to Bless the Martyr, and what a fantastic. Vertebrae. Uh-huh. My friend always described Vertebrae as a pregnant woman falling down the stairs at the last breakdown, and I think that's pretty accurate.
I love that.
Oh, also, I wanted to give a shout out to this Friday. Our friends in the Calloused Dad Boys will be dropping their newest single, Waco Jesus. We are very happy to pronounce that to you, and we all hope you listen. Shout out to our friends, Tom Nalfo and Travis Gentile, and Monostatic Records. It's going to be a new chapter in the burgeoning relationship and also a new pinnacle for Calloused Dad Boys.
And honorary casual Desmond Zantua will be kicking off a little summer tour with Career Day starting tomorrow at Ridgewood, New York, before heading over to a couple places in Ohio, Jersey, Illinois, PA. So try to give them a listen. Try to catch one of those if you can. But folks, you've heard enough from us, all right? We've got to shake off the rust a little bit here. You know, the ring rust is strong here, and so we just gotta kick it off a little bit, all right? But don't you worry, you've got no more 2 month waits ahead of you anymore. No, papas are here.
No more hiatus.
Papas are here, and we brought back the milk, and we're not gonna run out for a while. Unless I need
a pack. So we decide not to record the next time.
we'll see what happens. So folks, that's going to do it for us here. All right. We're glad to be back. Glad to have you, and enjoy the new theme I cooked up for all of you. You're welcome. That's how much I love and care about each and every one of you. So until next time, very soon, for Ryan and for myself, this has been and will always be the most electrifying must listen to podcast in sports entertainment. This is F. FC.